All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going? How are your hands? Did you keep all your fingers over the blasting over the weekend? Everybody okay? Nobody blew up any snakes or frogs or anything horrible? What'd you do? What'd you do out there? How'd it all go? Have good food? Did you have good food? Did it all work out? Was there any sense of celebration? I don't know. It all seems a little contrary in terms of freedom and independence to what a lot of people are experiencing right now in the world, in this country. But let's not get sad. I don't know. I have been, I mentioned, I think, last week, the on the show that I was going to listen to the Del Shannon record. Didn't I mention that? It was, I didn't even know the name of it, but I knew it was a record that I was supposed to have in my collection, and I got a reissue. I knew it was. It's called The Further Adventures of Charles Westover. It was a 1968 Del Shannon release, years after the Runaway. Guy trying to hold on, trying to make the shift from the early 60s to the late 60s. Big jump for some of those guys, right? Bobby Darin did a couple of hippie records. It's always interesting, the hippie records from the late 50s, early crooners. What am I, running a record podcast now? What the fuck is happening? I guess after last week and after the conversation I had, I must have made myself feel a little guilty because now I'm kind of re-engaged with the records. I'm taking the time when I have it, which is rare. For some reason, I'm still very busy. And, I'm listening to the records. It's very nice. It's time travel, man. It's time travel, mystical, magical stuff. And it was weird because I've said on this show a lot of times that the difference between music and comedy is that music is magic. I'll stand by that, but I had a conversation with Adam Pally and on his show, and he shifted my thinking a little bit, which isn't always, I mean, I'm open-minded, but he made me look at it a different way, a little bit. But nonetheless, it landed. But before I get into that, today I'm talking to Alexander Skarsgård. You know, he's a lot of stuff, this guy. True Blood, Big Little Lies, Robert Eggers' The Northman, Brandon Cronenberg's Infinity Pool. He played Lucas Mattson on Succession brilliantly. And now he's in this science fiction series called Murderbot. But I think calling it a science fiction series kind of undermines it. It's a comedy. And it's pretty funny. I watched a bunch of episodes in order to talk to him, and I'm still watching them. I think he's amazing at it. It's a very interesting character. He plays, I guess it would be some sort of cyborg. Is that, it's kind of a robot, but it's like a flesh one. You know, I don't know. I'm not up on the sci-fi lingo, but yeah, it's a flesh robot. The ones that are kind of mostly people, but also programmed. And he sort of is one that's been refurbished. And he did some, he might in his robot brain kind of remember bits and pieces of an erased event that he was probably at the center of, which I don't know for sure, but it looks like he might have had a glitch and killed a lot of humans at his last job. And he also sort of stacks his memory up with kind of garbage space sitcoms, which kind of eventually make him learn how to be a human in a way. And he's stationed on this somewhat of a progressive, almost a hippie mission with this crew of researchers. But it's funny. I will be back at Largo for a comedy and music show on Wednesday, July 23rd. Tickets are at largo-la.com. And I'm playing with some new people this time, and we're doing like a few of the songs I've done before, a couple of new ones. And it, look, man, I know that some of you sit through my guitar at the end. I don't expect a lot of people to do that, but it keeps me engaged. It keeps me playing. I think I've gotten better. Sometimes I sound better than others. Also, it's like with the weekly update that I think you can still sign up for at WTFpod.com, because it looks like, yeah, I'm going to try to keep that going after the podcast ends, but that keeps me writing. But there is this part of me that thinks like, well, I got to focus more on music. And then I spend time with real musicians trying to work out songs. And one of the reasons I'm playing with these different people is because I wanted more practice time. I wanted to really, you know, feel the vibe of playing with people because I don't do it enough. And when we do it, it's only for like a day, couple of rehearsals before the actual performance. And I don't feel like I've fully acclimated to playing with other individuals. I don't feel like I'm good at that or know how to do it that well. And then I play with them and then I want to have fun, but I'm so fucking hard on myself and ultimately so insecure. It's a nightmare, not a nightmare. I mean, I did have some fun, but I wish I was more proficient. I've been playing a long time. I think I'm good at something. I think I'm good at how I play, but it's just, I choke, man. And I'm tired of it. So there goes that hobby in terms of really kind of leaning into it. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I'm gonna probably do a lot more music. It's like, oh my God, every time I do it, I'm like, Jesus, I kind of suck. What the fuck, man? I know these songs that when I sing, I choke up, I get nervous or vulnerable or whatever. My throat kind of closes up. Maybe if I keep doing it, I'll let go and I'll ease into it, because I have had moments where I feel like I'm pretty good at it in my own way, which is all that's important. I think I can do it, but Jesus, any creative endeavor, the main thing you're up against is just that wall inside yourself. Jeez, man, we are playing some interesting songs. I mean, I kind of teased it for those of you who are listening to the guitar at the end. I'm going to cover a Taylor Swift song. Maybe I told you that, but it's the one that kind of blew my mind and broke my heart. And I don't want to talk about it too much. Maybe some of you will come and maybe it'll be part of my repertoire. I don't know, but we figured it out. It's four chords, but it's, I guess I can tell you. We're going to cover Bigger Than the Whole Sky. And, you know, that's the kind of risk I'm taking. I'm not just up there playing some dirty blues, not doing some white guy barroom blues shtick. We're doing solid numbers, man. We're doing Buddy Holly. We're doing Velvet Underground. We're doing The Band. All right, there's a Jimmy Reed song in there. But, you know, for the most part, I'm trying to work a lot of muscles on the music thing. But it makes me very raw. Not raw. It makes me vulnerable. It makes me insecure. I've been in a war against embarrassment my entire life. But you know what? You will be humbled. You will be humbled by age. And hopefully at that point, you won't give a fuck anymore. Hopefully. So this observation that Adam had about, because he brought it up, Adam Pally, about music and comedy. And he was trying to tell me that they were similar. And I stuck by my old kind of rule, which is like, not really. But he was talking about crafting a bit, making it work, taking it out on the road, making it like a song, making it sing, making it, you know, do what it's supposed to do. It's like music. And my argument with that is always, but music is magic, and a piece of music can live with you forever, and you can return to it. And every time you listen to it, you might have a different experience. It might trigger memories. It might take on a whole new meaning. You might hear things you didn't hear before. You might realize that it doesn't hold what it used to. But either way, it's ethereal. And even bad music, even catchy music, there's nothing more consistent than locking into a song. And jokes just aren't like that, because he was talking about when you put a joke on a record. I'm like, yeah, but who the fuck listens to a joke more than once or twice, really? I think with the internet, yes, the internet, I think with YouTube and stuff and everything that's available, you can poke around in the history of everything and find something funny from the old days. that you can watch a few times. I've definitely done that. But generally speaking, a joke kind of, you know, it's one and done. My argument is that music can change you and it can change with you. And his argument is that, yeah, but some jokes stay with you forever and they change the way you think, or they provide you a certain amount of relief in moments that you need it, or they make you look at things in a different way, or you can tell a joke in relation to something that somebody's talking about or you're talking about, and it kind of heightens that conversation or buttons it or is the last word on it. There's something about jokes that are kind of designed to be the last word on things. That's the nature of a punchline, I guess. But I don't think I'd quite thought about it like that. And that was a kind of an exciting little revelation there, that there are so many jokes that represent a way of understanding or have shown me how to understand something or see something in a different way. I've always felt that. That's why I like comedy. But I didn't really put it together that you hold those in your mind, or you can go find them again, or you can paraphrase them badly, or you can kind of remember them. And they give you that same sort of, like, you know, Not necessarily an out loud laugh or anything, but that moment that you had with that joke at another time kind of reignites. So they stay with you in a different way. It's kind of in your mind, and songs can do that too. But when you hear a song outside of you, it's always like, holy shit. When you hear a joke outside of you, it's like, oh yeah, yeah, I know this one. Yeah, no, it's a good joke. Yes, yes, I'm going to sing some Taylor Swift. That's something I never thought I'd do in my life. That is something I never thought I'd do, and it's happening. See, there's no limits, folks. There's no limits to what you can do when you want to. I'm going to play a Taylor Swift song. So, okay, look, you guys, this guy I'm going to talk to right now is really, really one of the great actors working today. Totally. Alexander Skarsgård. And this show, Murderbot, is funny. It's streaming on Apple TV Plus. The season finale premieres this Friday, July 11th. And this is me talking to Alexander Skarsgård. So Sweden, dude.
Yeah.
Sweden. You know, Sweden has changed the world with snus. You know that, right?
Have you tried snus?
Yeah.
Really?
Dude, I'm on it right now.
Are you?
I mean, well.
Which one?
Well, what? Philip Morris, I guess, bought Zyn.
Uh-huh.
So Zyn's like a non-tobacco
the
snus.
The white one.
The white snus.
Yeah.
But back when I first got into snus, like when I found out about Swedish snus, I had to go on a website. I was ordering all these different kinds from Sweden. They'd come in the, you know, international packaging. It was very exciting.
General.
General, sure. Yeah, but then there was another one. Oh, I think, there were some ones that were so strong. There's General. That's the one that was sort of over here a bit in smoke shops. But there's like 100 different kinds there.
Yeah, there's one very popular in Sweden. And I think for marketing reasons, they should probably change the name, because it's called, in Swedish, it's Göteborgsrapier.
Oh, well,
but it's spelled Gothenburg Rape. R-A-P-E.
Oh, yeah. R-A-P-E.
Yeah. So That's not
great marketing.
Not great marketing here in the States.
There was one that I was on that was like, you know, had so much nicotine. I just remember it like I'd be sweating. But I was on the tobacco snus for a long time. And now this is American product. And but it's Swedish in origin.
How many? They have different dots, right?
The level of strength. This one's just three milligrams. So like when you get up to six, for me, it's a little sweaty. And then some people are doing 12s, and I'm fucking, the day's over.
Three fucks me up.
Yeah.
I was never a smoker, and I didn't really do snus growing up either.
Yeah.
And then I started to party snus when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And I just like put one little guy up.
Yeah.
And when I was just like drinking.
Right.
It would give me a little buzz because I was in, you know, used to nicotine. So I'd get,
sure.
I'd get a little
kick.
Oh, yeah,
of course.
You
know? Yeah.
And I still do occasionally. Like, I'll have a little snooze here and there. But those guys, the Are they stronger, the non-tobacco nicotine ones? Because
I don't think so. Maybe they are. I don't know, because I remember doing like some tobacco ones that were like 22 or 21 milligrams, you know, and it was different. Because these things, like three, gets me.
I feel nauseous if I have leave that in for like 10, 15
minutes.
With
the white snus?
The white snus, yeah.
But the other one didn't do the same thing?
Not really.
Yeah, I think it might be a little different. Yeah, because it's just pure nicotine. You don't have to get it out of the leaves.
Yeah.
It's just this white powder soaked in nicotine. Yeah. So it's probably a little more efficient in terms of the delivery.
But I didn't know that they, because I remember like years ago, you would have to ship it from Sweden like to get it out here. And then a couple of delis in New York started selling it. I remember that was a big thing when—
General.
And I remember Swedish friends in New York, it was a big day when you could actually buy it there.
Yeah.
But now I think it's like everywhere, right?
Well, these are.
The
white snus is now an American phenomenon.
But what about the because I know that Camel started doing like a similar thing, like a tin can that looked kind of like that.
I don't think that's around anymore. That's true. That was a tobacco snus, but it was an American. But you can't get the Swedish brands aren't, you can see them in smoke shops sometimes. They only have a couple.
Okay.
But not the white snus. But now there's like 10 different kinds of this white snus.
But you're not on tobacco at all?
No, man. I smoked. I used to smoke all the fucking time.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. I've been on nicotine on and off for most of my life. Sometimes I do the, I thought I had them with me. Now I'm going to panic. What happened to those?
Well, you had them in your hand just like a minute ago.
Yeah, I had those, but I also do these nicotine lozenges. God damn it. I'll be all right. I'll get through this. Which are just, they're actually a smoking cessation thing, like a nicotine gum.
Okay.
And they make them, you know, Walgreens makes them. They're to quit smoking.
Okay.
But they're good. Yeah, you know, they get the cinnamon ones.
What about the vaping?
No, I don't do no vapes.
No?
No, what the fuck is in vapes? I mean, I'd rather whatever I'm going
to— Whatever you want.
Yeah, I know it's all kinds of flavors.
Yeah.
No, but I don't know what the smoke is. I don't know how it generates. I don't know the chemicals. I'd rather just deal with something kind of in my mouth and going into my stomach than filling my lungs with some sort of weird, fake steam.
Yeah, yeah. No, I stay away from those as well.
Yeah.
A little snooze here and there, that's about it for me.
Right?
Yeah.
But, like, I love Sweden. I was there for, like, a few days once. And
stand-up? Or?
Yeah, in Stockholm. I went to see that ship that they have preserved.
Vasa.
Yeah.
The Vasa ship.
It's kind of wild, man.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like they got to keep it moist.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's this giant ship that didn't even go anywhere.
It sunk on its maiden voyage after about 5 minutes in Stockholm Harbor.
But it's not even a Viking ship.
No,
right?
No. It's like, no, it's from the 1600s.
Yeah.
And it was like the crown jewel of the Swedish Royal Navy.
Right.
And it was a big, big thing when they're going to, you know.
And it just went right down.
It went right down. And then they, they picked it up and I think it was in the 60s.
They pulled it up?
They pulled it up in the 60s. And now it's a very moist museum.
Yeah. It's so well preserved. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
The whole thing's eerie.
Yeah.
I went to a few museums there. I went to I saw some of those Viking ships too.
Yeah.
They have
a Viking museum right next to the Vasa Museum.
Yeah. Not as in good a shape.
No. Viking slightly ship. Older as well. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you grow up? And also there's a beautiful art museum there, right down the street too, right? Right on the water there.
Yeah. They got the Moderna Museum, the Modern Museum.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it.
They also have the Naturhistoriska and Nordiska, like the one that looks like a big castle almost.
Yeah, that's the
Nordic Museum, Nordiska.
Yeah,
Museum.
Yeah. Yeah, I found it to be quite a nice place. Felt very comfortable.
Yeah.
Not too stressed.
I just moved back like 2 years ago.
Where were you?
I was, out here in L.A. For many years. And then, first New York and then out here and then moved back to New York.
Yeah.
And then about 2 years ago, I moved back to Stockholm.
Did you grow up there?
I grew up there, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So how's it feel to be back?
It feels pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was here for 20 years. But my family were always based in Stockholm.
All of them. Acting dynasty?
Yeah. The 57 siblings and my parents and everyone was in Stockholm. I was the only one out here. Obviously, my dad and my brothers who were actors come out here a lot for work, but everyone was based in Stockholm.
That's fucking crazy that you're all actors.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't
I mean, yes, it is crazy. We're not all actors. We have...
How many siblings are there?
I have no idea. No, we're eight Six siblings, full siblings, and then two half brothers on my dad's side.
Six full siblings, and out of them, like, four act.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Four, and the kids, my brothers and my they're teenagers, and they're also kind of.
You mean your nephews?
No. My brothers, but the young ones on my dad's side, the teenagers that.
Oh, he's got some young kids.
Yeah, well, they're 12 and 15.
Oh my God! How old is he?
he's 74. Yeah,
just keeps doing it.
So I was born in the 70s, and dad had kids in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and 10s. So over five decades.
So there's really a lot of them.
Yeah. And more might be popping up down the road.
We'll say. No. And all the other kids, you're the oldest one. And then there's four of you, right, with in the first batch. Five total.
Six total.
And you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest, yeah. And so, I'm the oldest. And Gus, who's an actor. Sam, who's a doctor. He followed, like, mom's path. Yeah. And then Bill, who's an actor.
Yeah.
And the one girl, Aya.
She an actor?
She's not an actor. Oh. And then Walter, the young one, also an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was the one who played in Nosferatu?
That was Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you both played vampires.
Yeah. We did. Yeah.
What did you think of that performance?
It's incredible. And it was directed by Robert Eggers.
He's the best. I've talked to him.
Yeah. I did a movie with him, The Northman, a couple of years
ago.
That's
fucking crazy movie, dude.
Yeah.
That guy Eggers is a fucking genius.
I adore that guy. He's incredible.
He's like a visionary.
Yeah. Like, very unique style of type of filmmaking. It's
because like The Northman, after I talked to him, he's such a meticulous about history and about how he wants things to look and about the way he shoots.
Yeah.
So by the time like I finished talking to him, it must have been for The Northman, and I watched that in a theater. That thing is fucking crazy.
Well, it was hard, my friend. Because the thing is, like, both The Witch and The Lighthouse are a bit more contained in terms of the scope and I'm not going to say character-driven, but, like, it revolves. It's a smaller story, cast. The Northman is an
epic
Viking film. And, and the way that Rob and Jaren, his DP, the way they shoot is very meticulous and very planned and very detailed. And Rob doesn't like cuts. So most scenes are shot as a one-er with just one long camera take that he plans 6 months in advance. But when you have a scene with 40 berserkers and 300 extras and horses, but to do that as a one-er with no cuts is it's hard.
But
and we all came to realize that it was really it was daunting. And
to get one take could take a week.
Yeah, and also kind of demoralizing sometimes, because if you do a long, basically a long fight scene, a big battle scene, and everything works, and you like everyone, everyone's just like, yeah, we got it, and then Jaren, the DP, is like, this chicken in the background, like 45 minutes into this long shot, just flew in the wrong direction or something. Like, then you got to go. It's not like, because you can't cheat it. Normally on a normal movie, you'll have like, B camera got that. We'll just focus on this one little jump or this one stunt.
Yes.
But this was like, then you're like, okay, back to one.
And how mad can you get at a chicken?
Yeah. poor chicken.
You can't yell at a chicken.
So we, ended up doing those long, long fight scenes.
And you're wearing armor?
Yeah. I mean, or naked in the middle of the night, freezing.
Oh, those ones, yeah.
Yeah. But it was hard, but I also knew that going into it, because we'd been prepping and planning for the movie for many years, and I obviously knew Rob's style and his way of working. So it wasn't a surprise to me. It was a very different way of working from how I'm normally working on set. So,
what do you mean? But, like, why?
Well, usually... you're a bit more liberated and free, and you can move around. And like, no, it's not as specific. And I think that can feel creatively claustrophobic.
Yeah.
If you're like, wait, I got to walk up here, turn, hit the light, and then slowly move, and the camera will come around. And then I get it. You feel like a robot,
right?
But again, going into it, I knew that that was going to be that's Rob's process. So then I was like, well, my job is to try to instill some life into that, I guess, and try to make that feel organic in some way.
Wow. So how long was that shoot?
It was 7 months. During the pandemic, before the vaccine was out, it was one of the first productions up and
masked?
Running. Well, we weren't, but obviously when we were shooting the film, but whenever the camera wasn't rolling, we were masked. And
were they testing every day?
Every day, because we were kind of like a guinea pig production. Because we were in March, beginning of March, we were in Belfast where we were going to shoot the film. 6 days from principal photography, and as everything was starting to shut down in Italy, you know, in Milan, all that, like with the hospitals and everything, the chaos out there.
Yeah.
And we were like, are we still starting this film in 6 days? And we didn't really know. We were just like, okay, well, I guess we'd continue with this prep.
Yeah.
And then finally they pulled the plug. So everyone went home for a couple of months. And then we came back in end of June. To start again, that was one of the first productions to be up and running. So there was no real protocol of how to do this during a pandemic. So it was a little trial and error, I guess, and like trying to figure out how to do that.
But, and on top of it being such a strenuous production, it's fucking crazy.
It was, but again, like in a sadistic way, I enjoyed every second of it as well because I was so excited about the working with Rob on that movie and playing that character. And so
it looks so good. It looks so good. Like, you know, it's one of these movies where, like, I get excited because a guy like him, like Eggers, you know, you're dealing with, like, a real genius here who has a vision.
Yeah.
And it's so fucking rare that, like, he's not going to bend to expectation.
No.
He's going to make exactly the movie he wants to make.
Yeah.
And it must be, you know, pretty exciting to work with a guy like that, especially if you trust him.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. And because Nosferatu, that fucking movie's great.
Well, he does so much research. Like, it's just the attention to detail and everything. Like, you know, that we had 400 fittings, and he would be like, well, this seam looks a bit more like the 11th century than the 10th century. Can we try this? And the stitching here's a little like more, you know, 1145. And that's like a slightly regional difference.
Who's going to catch that?
Yeah.
Like, who gives a fuck on some level?
Yeah.
But it's in there.
Yeah.
You know, and Eggers is like, you know, that stitching's got to be in there.
Yeah.
For one nerd, like, he really nailed this. It was definitely 1100.
But then, you know, like, in a way, and I'm too lazy for that kind of preparation, but personally, but there's something about, because Rob makes 2,000 decisions like that with the stitching. And combined, it will make, I think, like, watching his films, it feels authentic. Mm-hmm. You may not know that the stitching is perfect, but it is.
But it all adds up.
But it all adds up.
Yeah.
And it gives it a richness, and it just feels like you're transported into a different time and a different place.
Yeah. So what was it? Now, in terms of the family business. I mean.
The dynasty.
Yeah. But I mean, like, do you grow up knowing that you're going to do that?
No. I was... my brother Gus always knew from a very early age.
Your younger brother.
You're my younger brother. Yeah. He always knew. He was like, I'm going to be an actor like that.
Yeah.
I went the opposite direction. I was like, no, this is not for me. I wanted to.
What?
I don't know. I didn't want to rebel, but I guess I wanted to. My family is and was very bohemian. It was all, obviously, dad an actor, but the extended family was all like composers, artists, painters, that's, writers, poets.
That's so funny.
So it was a very, in hindsight, like, incredible household to grow up in because it was like a huge family.
What'd your mom do?
Open, she's a doctor.
Oh, yeah.
But she was kind of the only academic out of the bunch.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, it was, again, like, big open door. Everyone was there. Like, everyone lived in the same neighborhood in South Stockholm. So grandma and grandpa across the street and cousins above us in the apartment above.
And they were all like artists and weirdos.
Yeah, a lot of artists and eccentric weirdos.
Yeah.
But as a 13-year-old, I just want it to be normal. I just want it to have a normal family. This was like, you know, you're like walking around, like dudes walking around in caftans and like reciting poetry. I was like, this is, no. Like
you want a little more control.
Yeah.
A little less creative chaos.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's very uncommon for a teenager who's trying to figure out who he or she is. Like,
sure. But it's just so funny.
You want normalcy, you know, like you want just like to blend in. You don't want to stick out or be like.
Yeah. You don't want your parents to like, I saw your uncle down on the street wearing a hat the other
like exactly. That. Exactly. And she, like, my dream was to have a dad who wore like a gray suit and drove a Saab 9000 to his office,
right,
you know?
Right. Yeah. Just a little like, you know, it's not all about them.
Exactly. And that's how I think I was very much. Because people kind of assumed that I was going to become an actor. I did a couple of things when I was young, like very young, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
How'd you get dragged in? What, dad was like, I got a friend who's going to...
No, dad's friend, Allan Edwall, who's a legendary Swedish actor, director, was in Fanny and Alexander, Bergman film, and tons of other fantastic films. He was going to direct the film in the... when I was like 8, and he needed an 8-year-old kid for the movie.
Yeah.
And he was over at our house with all the other eccentric artists. And he was just like, I guess he saw me in a corner. He was like, hey,
can I have that kid?
Can I have that kid? I need an 8-year-old kid. So then, yeah, that's how I kind of ended up doing that. And then, like, you know, it wasn't like I was a Hollywood in the Hollywood sense of like a child actor.
Yeah,
I didn't have like, headshots.
Or, right.
I didn't know how to tap dance or
something. Like, didn't have a full resume of skills.
No. But it was kind of like that. Dad's friend would be like, hey, Alex, do you want to jump in and do this thing? And I did, you know, here and there till I was 13. And then I kind of stopped and then was just like, I'm going to do something completely different.
And that's when you rebelled. It's so funny. Most people choose acting to rebel.
Yeah, yeah.
You were going to like, what did you choose?
My
like,
way to rebel engineering? Was to go buy a gray suit and study engineering.
You know? Did you? No.
No, but I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I studied political science and then I went into the military in Sweden, which is, I guess, a way to rebel against my pacifist hippie family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were the requirements of the military in Sweden? What did you end up having to do? What branch of the military?
I joined a unit called Säkjakt, which is technically part of the Royal Navy, but we were land-based on the small islands in the archipelago outside of Stockholm, and our job was to basically protect the islands from any kind of sabotage or terrorism.
And did you see a lot of action?
Well, it was during it was like late 90s, so it was like the tail end of the Cold War.
Okay.
When everyone was saying like, you know.
Russia's going to take over?
No, the opposite.
Oh.
Everyone was just like, all right, we're done with the Cold War. Russia will never again be a threat to anyone.
Yeah.
This, you know, it's like eternal peace now. Because I didn't join for any like patriotic reasons or because I love guns or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think it was just like
Uniform.
I just wanted to wear a sexy uniform. I was 19. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I didn't want to go to drama school. So I was just like, I don't know, I'll do this. And I was walking through this park or square in Stockholm, and recruiters were out there handing out pamphlets for this unit.
Yeah.
And obviously they made it look like super cool,
exciting.
You know? Yeah. Because you know, the pictures were all like, you know, you're diving and kayaking on the islands and just like, you know, jumping off boats and like helicopters. And so for a 19-year-old, I was like, all right, that sounds fun.
Did you learn how to scuba dive or anything?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So like what your old man, was he like, what are you doing?
No. No, I think he saw what I was up to.
Yeah.
Because again, there was also like, I think it's a bigger decision. Last time Sweden was at war was like in 1812. So it's been like 200 years.
So there wasn't a big threat of him.
So, and again, this was like late 90s. It was a very stable time in Europe. It was like, you know, it was like it was post the war in Yugoslavia.
And
it was just, again, an era of like, all right, eternal peace now.
Yeah.
So he knew that it was a very just kind of like selfish endeavor for me, just like a way for me to grow up and, and become independent, I guess. So he knew that I wasn't going to get shipped overseas to deployment somewhere, you know.
How long were you in?
A year and a half.
And did you learn anything?
Nothing.
Zero.
Yeah.
You learned how to be on an island.
I learned how to like fall off a boat without hurting myself, like as it's going 40 knots, you know.
And so, like, all right, but your other siblings, were they like, what the fuck are you doing?
I think maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
Again, Gus was very, he was like already like getting ready to go to drama school was like, why? But they also knew that I was not interested in acting at the time, and I was very adamant about doing something else.
Yeah.
And just kind of finding my own path. And so they, I think they weren't that surprised.
Did your dad know Bergman?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he worked with him on stage.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So was he one of the people that was around?
Not really. They didn't socialize much outside of the theater.
Yeah.
But yeah, we would, because Dad did repertoire theater when I was a kid, so he would, like, rehearse during the day, perform at night, new plays constantly, and you know, you spend several hours there, and so a way to kind of hang out with Dad was to go to the theater and hang out there because again, he was there all day and then at night,
watching him repeat things,
so and technically. I have worked with Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he, I can't remember which play it was, but he directed something with my dad.
Yeah.
And the backdrop was going to be a photo of my dad, of three kids. So they shot, took a photo of myself, Gus, and Sam.
Yeah.
Dressed up in like a sailor outfit.
Yeah.
That was going to be projected as the backdrop of that play.
Yeah. So it was?
Well, I don't know. You tell me, can I say that I've worked with Ingmar Bergman? Like, I was 8 years old. They took a photo of me, and it was the backdrop of a
play.
So I guess I wasn't really directed by him.
No.
I don't even know if he was there when they took the photo.
But it was in the show.
It was in the show, a still photo of me. So I wasn't really on stage, but.
No, I think that counts.
All right, I'm going to put that on top of my resume right now. Resume.
Appeared in an Ingmar Bergman play.
Yeah.
I did a horror show where, you know, they cut me up into pieces. And they did the molds, right? So, and part of my head and like my arm was hanging in a meat locker. And I got paid for that.
Did you get to keep it?
No.
Yeah.
No, but I have a picture of it. But I just thought it was funny that because it was me that, you know, it's carved out as a paying acting job.
Yeah.
Just like my head hanging on a meat hook. I was like, that's pretty good gig. But it's similar.
Yeah. I got two heads at home.
You do?
On my own, yeah.
From what?
One from Infinity Pool.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Brandon Cronenberg film.
Yeah.
And one from Martabot, the Apple TV Plus show.
Oh, the one you're on now?
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah.
You got a head from that?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what happens. I only watched the ones that were available. They didn't send me the whole thing. I've seen four of them. Before we get to that, though, where do you end up training?
Well, after the military, I moved to Leeds in England.
Yeah. Oh.
I don't know what I did there, but, well, I know exactly what I did, but I didn't study, that was sure. Like, I was
that what you were supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I enrolled at a university in Leeds, but it was mostly just like going to pubs and having a good time.
Yeah.
And while I was out there, I kind of started thinking about acting again, and it was like, and I resisted it. I tried to find something else to do. I was considering a bunch of other things.
Yeah.
Like, I was into architecture for a while and considering that. But then I was like, all right, well, because I did remember like having fun when I was young on those jobs.
Yeah.
When I worked with Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah. In the still work?
When I was Bergman's muse, mm-hmm. I remember being creatively fulfilled as an 8-year-old.
That would have a big impact, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, but I remember that, like, I had being on set, I had no creative process. It wasn't anything, like, pretentious like that.
Yeah,
but, like, I just remember, like, that sense of camaraderie, family on set was really, like, fun and exciting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I quit when I was 13, partly because I did a TV movie in Sweden that got a little bit of attention, and that freaked me out because people started recognizing me, and I was, again, 13, and I
didn't love it.
Well, that, no, because I wanted just to blend in.
Right.
The whole point of like my Bohemian family and weirdos.
Oh, now
and,
I'm
like,
one of them.
Now I'm one of them.
Yeah.
So like that's, you know, I you know, it's a 180 turn and just went in a different direction. Yeah. But then when I was living in Leeds, I was trying to figure out, like most people in, I guess, when they're 20, 21, what do I want to do?
Yeah.
And then I remember thinking back, like, well, it wasn't so much about the job itself that I didn't like. It was everything around it. So before I kind of dismiss it for good, maybe I should just go to drama school and just feel it out and see what it's like, you know, so I don't end up like 30 years from now being bitter for not trying.
Are you having conversations with your dad about it?
Yeah, because someone had to pay for that drama school. And it sure as hell wasn't going to be me. Yeah, so so I did have a conversation with him.
But like, was he, you know, like excited, or do you feel like, you know, all right, go give it a try, or like, I think you'd be
good? No, he's always been, he doesn't care about us. He's not excited.
Is that a Swedish
thing? He's too selfish.
Yeah.
But he's been very, I've kind of admired his approach. He's always been incredibly supportive no matter what we do, like in what are our choices in life.
Right.
And he just wants 8 happy kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he doesn't care if we're what, you know, what we do and or if it's a prestigious job or not, or he's just like, well, do what makes you happy. If you feel this, then so he's been very hands off in his approach to like getting us into the industry or keeping us out of the industry. He's always been like, you'll find your own way.
What about your mom?
Very much the same. Yeah.
Because they weren't together for most of your life? Or
they were together till I was, well, 30.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then they split up, but remain close friends.
Like, is she down the street kind of deal?
Well, to the point where she moved out to our summer home permanently on one of the islands in the archipelago.
That you used to protect?
That I used to protect with my life. So she's very safe out there. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, good.
Yeah, I was crawling around in the bushes. And then Dad and Megan, his wife, were going to build a house on the same property, just like 50 yards from Mom's house.
Yeah.
And they were all really excited about it. But it was like, for topographical reasons, they couldn't do it. It didn't make sense.
Wow, that's pretty.
It was like rocky. And
they really are Bohemians.
Yeah, but then they ended up buying a cottage like 100 yards down the road.
Your dad did, and his new wife.
So they're on the same island. We're like, they're very, you know, and we go on vacation.
That's wild.
It's
a nice story. And did she remarry?
No. No, she didn't. But they, I'm very fortunate that they all remained friends.
Yeah,
and it was very civilized in a way. And but she was also very, kind of hands off. And again, like the approach was like, we're here if you need us, but find your own way.
It's also good that like you didn't have this, because it seems like I meet people who act and they have a very sort of reasonable approach. Like they like working and they do the work. And they're not like, you know, hung up on, you know, necessarily doing the right thing all the time.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
Like
when you were starting out, you were just working?
Well, when I was starting out, so what I did was basically from Leeds, I applied to a theater school in New York, a college.
Which one?
Marymount, Manhattan.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So that's when, I was like, Dad, I'm going to try this now if you're cool with it. And can you pay my tuition? And so I moved from Leeds to New York.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. And then I dropped out. Yeah.
How long?
I lasted about 4 days.
4 days?
No, I didn't. No, it was 6 months.
Okay.
At the acting school.
And he bailed.
I bailed.
Why?
A girl.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where was she?
Stockholm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So then you go back home?
Yeah. I mean, so I met a girl 3 weeks before moving to New York. So I was home and I was in Sweden over the summer between Leeds and New York and fell in love with her. And this was like, you know, in the 1900s.
Yeah.
So this was, communication was tougher.
You couldn't.
Like, plus, I didn't have money to like fly home over Thanksgiving or anything like that. It was like, you know, so I was in New York.
Phones and snail mail?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Like, I would call from, I couldn't afford calling from the cell phone, so I would go down to, like, a phone booth.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had some, like...
The international phone booth?
Yeah, so, like, an international phone booth, because it was cheaper.
Buy a card?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And call, like, so we talked once a week, but then...
Don't know what's going on once a week.
I think she went back to her ex-boyfriend.
During that time?
Yeah, yeah.
And you went back to save it? You went back to make your stand?
And I don't blame her, because, again, like, I was going to be there for 4 years.
Yeah.
And so that kind of broke my heart a little bit. And then the school was fantastic. I really liked it. It had nothing to do with the school. And I really felt excited about being in that kind of creative environment and doing plays and with the other students. And
But you went back heartbroken and you got your ass handed to you?
I was like, you know what? I got to go back and salvage this because she's the one.
Yeah,
I'd known her for 3 weeks, but I was like, this is it.
Felt good.
I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah.
So I went back to Sweden, and then, we got back together.
Oh, so it worked out.
For 2 weeks.
And you'd already dropped out of school?
I'd already dropped out of school, went back. We reunited, and it didn't last very long. But then I was in Stockholm, and I'd already dropped out. So then I, kind of
just started working.
Started working, yeah.
You had a few chops. You did 6 months. Solid drama school work.
Well, I felt like I've learned everything I need to know.
Yeah. Did you?
No.
Oh.
No, God, no. So then I started doing like odd jobs in Stockholm. I was working in a coffee shop and a clothing store.
Oh,
I was
not
like
acting.
A busboy. No. Just doing like odd jobs.
So when do you make your break?
Couple of years later, I didn't really have a big break, but I started getting like small parts
in Swedish films,
television, smaller things.
Yeah.
And then I was out here in LA. Dad was shooting something. I was on vacation. I think it was in 2000.
Yeah.
And his manager knew that I had just started in Sweden doing like the little, smaller jobs. So like I was, definitely not like a star in Sweden, but I was like a young working actor, occasionally working actor. And she asked if I wanted to go to an audition, and it was for Zoolander, Ben Stiller comedy, to play one of his roommates. And it's like only 2-3 scenes. But I did. And I ended up getting the job, and which was obviously surreal and kind of a dream.
It's a funny movie.
It was incredible. It was incredible. And again, like I was a kid on vacation here. Yeah. I didn't have representation or anything, and then ended up getting that.
You kind of fit. They needed it's almost exotic. It made sense, right?
Yeah.
Swedish guy.
Exactly. Because there was going to be three roommates. Yeah. And it was going to be like one of those, like we live together, but like models from around different parts of the world.
Right. I remember. It was Owen too, right?
Yeah. Owen Wilson.
I just did a show with him. He's a funny guy.
Oh, did you? I didn't get to work with him, unfortunately.
Because he was the competition.
I think I auditioned for that role.
Yeah?
I think the first audition was
for role?
Hansel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously didn't get that. But then they called me back to audition for one of the roommates.
Well, that's what's the funny thing about you is like, even on this Murderbot show, comedy isn't, it's rare that I like them, because a lot of them are not great.
Yeah.
But this one is pretty funny. Like, it's funny. Murderbot is funny.
I was excited when I read it. I thought it was like a funny character.
It's
very
funny,
different. It wasn't what I expected when I heard the title.
Yeah,
and like,
I had no
sci-fi
idea.
Called Murderbot. I was expecting something way more kind of classic tough guy protagonist. And then instead it's like this socially awkward.
Socially awkward guy who's kind of half trying to learn how to be human from watching old science fiction TV shows.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I found it quite endearing, and that's kind of what drew me to it.
But it's a real comedy. I mean, it's not like, because I didn't know what I was getting into, Murderbot. I'm like, it's like a satire of a sci-fi thing.
Yeah. And a mix of that and like workplace comedy.
It's just so funny that like, once again, as this guy, as Murderbot, as a security robot who has overridden his main panel.
Yeah.
And then you're surrounded by bohemians again.
Exactly, again.
Like you're in the one sort of interstellar exploratory crew that's just a bunch of bohemians.
Who just want to like tactile, want to hug me. And it's just like, and it freaks Murderbot out because it's not used to that kind of treatment.
How many episodes are there?
10.
Oh, see, like, because I'm just at the end of 4 where, you know, you've pulled the thing off the back of your neck, but you're already wired to kill.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what happens. I imagine you learn how to become a human, kind of.
Well, it's again, Murderbot is finds itself and surrounded by these press ox people that are very like space hippies.
Yeah.
And they treat and it freaks Murderbot. In a way, it's like you mentioned, Murderbot has hacked its governor module, so it's gained free will autonomy. Yeah. It calls itself Murderbot, and it has all these plans of going out into like a distant galaxy and go on these epic adventures, but then it's kind of like waiting for the right moment to take off.
Yeah.
And starts to kind of procrastinate and watch a space soap opera.
Yeah.
While it's doing that, it's kind of reluctantly forming relationships with these humans
yeah.
around it. Like you mentioned, a way to learn about, because it's an android, so it has organic components.
Yeah.
But a way to learn about who it is by watching this space soap opera.
Yeah.
Because then it's like...
Yeah.
It feels safe to watch that and learn about, like, as an anthropological study, because then you can pause whenever you want.
Yeah.
It's way more uncomfortable when you actually, like, have to deal with the humans,
right.
yourself.
Yeah.
So over the course of these 10 episodes, it's like they get thrown into a lot of crazy stuff, but Murderbot is just constantly trying to kind of distance itself from them emotionally, but then obviously it's hard and it starts to kind of... care about them in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It's very funny because the space soap opera is so over the top.
Oh, that was a dream. Yeah. It was a dream. And my buddy, do you know Jack McBrayer?
I met him once. I've never interviewed him.
So Jack is an old friend of mine.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you know that guy?
He did a movie called, I want to say Movie 42.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
Was doing a show with Jack.
Yeah.
One of the skits for that movie. It was like the movie was like a bunch of short films, basically.
Yeah.
And another buddy of mine, actually from back home in Stockholm, had written that sketch.
Oh, okay.
So, and they were shooting in New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, my old childhood friend wrote it and my girlfriend was in it. So,
so you met him then?
I went to set and just fell in love with Jack. Yeah. So I lost a girlfriend, but I gained a Jack.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's probably a longer relationship to gain a Jack.
It is. It's a lifetime.
He's a
lifetime.
Funny guy, right?
Oh, he's incredible. Yeah. So he was kind enough to come up. We shot it in Toronto. So he came up to play one of the crew members there.
It's so funny because you got this range where, like, I can tell you really like doing comedy.
I loved it. It was also kind of... When it landed in my lap, I think it was totally something I was so ready for and excited to do because I'd done The Northman that we just talked about.
Yeah, and you've done Succession.
And also like Infinity Pool, which was also quite intense and dark.
Yeah.
I mean, Succession was definitely more comedic, but I think after The Northman and Infinity Pool, two great experiences, but, you know, pretty intense, dark subject matters.
Sure.
This felt just like a little palate cleanser.
Like so fun.
Yeah, I just wanted to do something a bit lighter and
But it's crazy fun. How you came up, though. I mean, you were in these, like that Generation Kill thing. I mean, that was kind of this big, menacing, kind of real historical war thing, right?
Yeah.
How'd you get cast in that?
I got lucky, man.
But I mean, like, you got to be real American to do that thing.
Well, it was, the thing was, they, I'd been out here. So after Zoolander, because Zoolander was my first audition out here.
And you just stayed here.
You're like, well, I went back to Sweden because I was doing a play in Stockholm. So I went back, but I remember going back and telling and then after Zoolander, because again, I didn't have representation. I didn't have an agent when we did that. But then after that, I got an agent.
Yeah.
And she said, well, if you, you know, when you're done with the play, you should come out here.
Yeah.
And because I was like, I'd done one audition, I booked the job. I remember coming in Sweden. I was like, it's easy in Hollywood. It's so, you just like roll up and Ben Stiller's in the room and then, you know, you book the job.
Yeah.
So I came back here.
Yeah.
Very naive.
Yeah.
And then I didn't book a job for till 2007.
Like, oh my God.
I was here auditioning for a lot of really.
How many years is that?
6 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, I went back and forth. I was in Sweden a little bit, and then I would do these like smaller things in Sweden to try to, and save up a little bit of money, come out here, rent an apartment somewhere, and do all these like pilot seasons and audition for everything.
Oh, yeah. So you
did the whole thing. And then when Generation Kill came up, because I found that often anything that I got excited about, in the end, they would always hire someone who was a bit more established.
Yeah.
But when this came up, they wanted not unknown actors, but quite most of the guys. It's about a platoon of Marines during the first 5 weeks of the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
And they intentionally wanted a lot of unknown faces because it's like their style of shooting was also kind of documentarian.
Right. And it was to create an ensemble that wasn't distracted by star power.
It was a bunch of young guys. And they so had been out here and was slightly disillusioned. And I was like auditioning for everything. And then that came up and it was just so phenomenal. The writing was just so good. Yeah. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to get this because it was like a great role in a great piece by David Simon and Ed Burns. And, but then, and it was like a grueling month of auditions, callbacks. So I was in London auditioning for the director. I was in New York. I went down to Baltimore because they were shooting The Wire at the time, auditioned there. And then it was one of those where it's like, it's between you and another guy. And I'm like, oh God. And then 4 days of just like waiting for that phone call. And it was, and again, like at the time I had him basically worked in 6 years and I was going to go back home to Sweden to like unemployment. And it was either going to be that or like go to Namibia and do your dream job for 7 months, like with incredibly talented people. And then I got a call after 4 days.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's between you and two other guys now.
Oh Christ.
I was like, what? It was just me and it was down to me and one other guy. And now it's like a third guy comes
in. You're freaking out.
Yeah. Cause then I was like, oh, now some like established dude is coming in and you're like, I'll take that one. Yeah. Thank you very much. And then I think it was four rounds of more callbacks. I went down out here to LA for another callback and then up to New York.
Are they reading you with the other guys that are already cast and that kind of shit?
No.
Oh.
No.
Just you.
Yeah. Just me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you know how to, like, were you still speaking with Swedish accent?
Not really. Because I'd spent quite a few, I also went to, when I was 13, we lived in Budapest in Hungary.
Yeah.
My dad was shooting a movie there, so I went to an American school there.
Okay.
So
you had a handle on it.
A little bit, but still, like, they knew that I was Swedish, and I think some studio people and were probably a bit like, well, it's a very American role. So I'm like, or is this kid?
Yeah.
I mean, the Swedish kid, is he the right?
Yeah.
For
yeah.
But I didn't think I was going to get it. And then they call and then they're like, all right, well, you're flying to Namibia tomorrow.
Wow.
And then
how long were you there?
We were there for 7 months. We started in Namibia and then Northern South Africa. And then we ended in Maputo.
Wow.
And I was so certain that I was going to get fired and replaced. Because it was you know, to this day, it's like one of the best scripts I've ever worked on. Like, it was so good.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's no way I get to play Iceman on this show. Like, it's, of course, they're going to bring in like a big, you know, someone established.
Even
like
that you were there already, you still thought you were going to lose your gig.
It took me 3 months. So like I would calculate how much it would cost HBO to replace me.
as it kept going on?
Because I knew that they were going to replace me. I was like, they are definitely going to bring in, you know, the real actor.
It was
the real guy is going to do this. So the first couple of weeks, I was just waiting for someone to come knock on my trailer door.
God,
and be like, all right, you can pack up and go.
Yeah.
And then we did a couple of big battle scenes that I knew would cost a lot of money to reshoot. So I think we were like probably 2 months into production when I started like calming down a bit and be like, you know what? I think right now at this point, it's crazy expensive to replace me. So maybe I get to finish this, you know?
So you were able to enjoy it for at least a month or two?
I was still really nervous and really stressed about everything. it was an incredible group of guys, and and again, like, creatively super fun. But I was, I did enjoy it, but it, I never really relaxed, even though I didn't think they're going to replace me. I was still a bit stressed out about the whole situation.
Well, that's probably good. You were in a war.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe they added something.
But then, like, and then the huge break was the vampire thing, right?
Yeah.
And that was after Generation
Well, it kind of coincided, and I wasn't going to be able to do it initially.
Yeah.
Because...
True Blood.
True Blood, yeah. So I had auditioned for Bill, the other vampire in the love triangle, a year before this.
Yeah.
And didn't hear back, which I never did after any audition. So I was like, all right, that's another one that I don't have to think about, you know?
Fucking worst,
And then they call me when I'm in Maputo shooting, like we're like 5 months into Generation Kill. And they're like, well, we are now shooting, and they'd shot the pilot already, because Eric Northman doesn't show up till episode 4.
Yeah.
So they're like, so you remember that show True Blood that you auditioned for a year ago?
Yeah.
They are in production, and there's another role that they want to see you for, and it's like this Viking vampire.
That's me.
That's me. But they were supposed to go in the fall of 2007.
Yeah.
And I had 2 months left on Generation Kill, so I wasn't going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And then the writer's strike happened.
Oh.
And we, because we were in production, we already had all the scripts. We could finish shooting.
Right.
But True Blood ended up pushing to 2008.
Yeah.
Which enabled me to finish Generation Kill, come back to LA, audition for True Blood.
Yeah.
And so thank you all you writers out there for striking for me.
Yeah.
I know you did it just for me.
Yeah. It was fortuitous.
Yeah.
I hope you got what you wanted in the strike.
Yeah.
But you gave me a big opportunity.
Yeah.
Because that was fucking huge, man. That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
That kind of, I mean, you were, what were you employed for, 4 or 5 years?
We did 7 seasons.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But it was a really nice job, because it was also like, we shot it here in LA, and I lived in LA at the time, and
the best.
It was the stuff I got to do on the show was just so fun and crazy and over the top.
Yeah.
It never felt like procedural. It was never it didn't feel repetitive. It was just like,
it's vampire,
you know,
shit.
What am I doing today? I'm ripping a heart out of a guy's chest, and then I'm drinking his blood through the aorta. You know, it's a lot of
that sounds
crazy.
Like a fun day.
It was so much fun, and we had about 5-6 months off every year, so I could go off and do a movie or go see my family in Sweden. And like,
it's the best.
So it really was, you know, in hindsight, when you hear 7 years, I don't know how many episodes, like 80, 90 episodes, like it's a lot, but I loved it.
Yeah,
I
and
really
it was
did.
A huge show. And now you've got, like, you know, all the sort of young vampire freaks.
Yeah, when we started out, it was before Twilight had come out. So it was like, it was kind of before the vampire craze, you know? So it was a bit like, I obviously knew that Alan Ball was very talented.
Sure.
6 Feet Under and
Genius,
American Beauty. But I was still a bit like, this long-haired Viking vampire, like, are people going to like this? I don't want to care about this.
But didn't it like put you on the map?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely hit the zeitgeist in a way that, I mean, Generation Kill was a limited series.
Sure. But when do you become this like global sex symbol? Is that from the
vampires? I was probably born a global sex symbol, my friend.
Yeah.
No, I noticed a difference when season 2 of True Blood started, because the first season I had this like, because in the books, the book series that it's based on, Eric has long blonde hair, like a Viking mane, like a Viking Fabio.
Yeah.
So I wore a wig the first season. So I never got recognized after the first season.
Right.
It was also like a kind of a smaller, more antagonistic character the first season. And then the second season, it's my own hair. We cut the wig.
Yeah.
And so I remember it was like when season 2 started airing, that's when I started to
get the attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
It all had to do with your own hair. That was the big game changer.
These beautiful locks. Yeah. Golden locks. Yeah.
But it's like, it's wild though. It's like to be somebody who is, you know, seen that way, yet still have a career where you're like a character actor in a lot of ways, which I've said to actors before and they take that offensive, but I don't mean it that way. But to go from that and still be able to kind of lose yourself in roles that don't require you just to be like some hunk.
Yeah, but where's the fun in just playing the hunk over and over again?
I agree. But right? I think that's like the interesting thing about you is that you can do all these different things and you didn't let yourself be kind of, you know, put in a box.
But I think I was just, when I, after all those years of not being in a position where I had the privilege of choosing projects,
right.
Like I would just be like, all right, I got to audition for this jock boyfriend number four, movie, or and I did it. I was like, I just want to work.
Yeah,
I need
to
find a job.
Yeah.
So when I several years later got to a place where I had options where I could choose to play the jock or boyfriend number four or something
weird,
a bit weirder or a bit psychologically more interesting, then of course I'm going to gravitate towards that, you know?
So in entering these roles, I mean, did you do any other acting training outside of the 6 months at the...
No, but I mentioned that I work with Ingmar Bergman, right?
Yeah.
So I have that, you know?
But you just sort of picked it up. You just put your own craft together and put your own shit together on your own from working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ingmar said, you're ready to fly, my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
And, go soar.
And he rolled up the picture of you and he gave it to you.
Yeah.
Never forget this work we did together.
But no, I didn't. It was just those 6 months at Marymount Manhattan. And then when I was out here and not getting any jobs, I would go sit in at the Actor's Studio in West Hollywood.
Oh, really?
And just, do a little stuff, some scene work there and stuff.
Did that have an impact?
It did.
Yeah.
It did. I was just soaking it all in. And then I got to, then when they had the writers from Actor's Studio, they would, you know, do little scene work as they were writing. Then I got to participate and be in those scenes as the writers. And then like they would get notes from the other writers and then they go home and rewrite stuff.
Yeah.
A little place. And so I was never like a member
right.
of the, but I they were kind enough to
but
let
you
me.
You were around.
I was like a hang around.
Yeah. And they knew you were doing things.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Well, they knew I did nothing because I had all the time in the world. I was there a lot. But it was really, I was inspired by it for sure, because like going to all these auditions for projects that I didn't really believe in anyways, but doing it because I had to audition.
Sure.
Was a bit soul crushing sometimes. So it was really nice to go and sit there and just watch great actors do scene work.
Do the acting.
And just like through osmosis, just like feel that even though I wasn't a central part of it. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the audition process is humiliating. And a lot of times it's like two lines that you're like trying to get.
Yeah, but it's hard. It's really hard when you know that you're not right for the role.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're just like, you're volunteering to go get humiliated.
But you're also in a position where you're like, I haven't had an audition in 3 months. It wouldn't be that long, but like it'd been several weeks of nothing. And now my agent that I'm constantly worried that she's going to fire me or drop me, you know, calls me and is like, all right, I have this audition for you.
Yeah.
And then you read the material and you don't like it.
Yeah.
And you're completely wrong for the role.
Yeah.
But you're in no position to be like, you know what? I don't respond to this.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do it. Because then I'm like, she's going to drop me tomorrow. Like, I'm not booking any jobs.
I guess it toughens you up.
But then that's hard because you step into the room and you don't believe in yourself in this.
Sure.
And then, but you're like, I got to do this.
Yeah.
So, then it was nice to have, to be able to drop
go
in.
Go to the Actor's Studio.
Yeah.
Watch people pursuing the truth.
And hang out with my best friend, Martin Landau.
Martin Landau. The guy, I interviewed him years ago.
Did you?
Yeah. Well, it's great because there's none of those old cats around anymore.
No.
You know, that really kind of believed in the thing.
Yeah.
And the Actor's Studio was a real thing.
It was really, did you ever go there?
No.
No, but it was really, I was inspired by it.
Yeah. But when you did Big Little Lies, it's interesting to, you know, that, you know, you have this image and then you get to be that guy who's still like the good looking guy, but to be a monster.
Yeah.
I assume that some of these roles, you're sort of like, well, now this will put to rest that other thing.
Well, that was just such an incredible character. So that opportunity, and again, to explore that relationship with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Come on, what a dream, you know? Because he was also not just a monster.
Right.
It didn't feel like a cartoonish villain.
No.
Because it was, you know, a character who had a lot of love for his sons and a lot of love for his wife as well. And just there's an incredible deep darkness there, but there's also light and playfulness.
Complex.
And so there was a complexity there that was just like... just extraordinary.
It was a monster role, man. I mean, in terms of like what was available to explore and play.
Well, I don't want to say be lazy, but yeah, I guess be lazy through it because I didn't really have to work that hard. It was so well written.
Yeah.
And Jean-Marc Vallée, the late Jean-Marc who directed it, was just extraordinary to work with. And again, to kind of work on such fantastic material with someone like him and Nicole Kidman was just like, it was soul crushing at times because again, it was really, really dark and intense.
Yeah.
But I didn't really, it was when you have writing and collaborators that are so extraordinary, it makes it quite easy.
Yeah. I get it. Well, yeah, because you don't have to worry about that.
No.
You know, everything's in place for you to just do the thing.
And I just, from reading it, I could see who the character was, and I was intrigued by him. And
that's
so
awesome.
That, yeah.
So what happens now, like after you do this? Are you going to do, you got a movie in the hopper?
Well, this is like the tail end of, I've been bouncing around these past 2 months.
Promotion
for Murderbot.
Yeah.
And then this movie called Pillion. We went to Cannes with.
Oh, you're just in Cannes?
Yeah.
Oh, that did well, right?
Yeah, it's a little kinky gay biker movie.
Yeah, I think I saw some reel of you with Pedro. Did you like hug him or something?
Yeah.
That
I gave him a sloppy kiss.
Yeah.
He's Pedro's a friend, and he was at our premiere.
It was
an extraordinary experience.
Yeah.
The only time I've had a film at Cannes was it 2012 maybe with Melancholia, Lars von Trier.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I was shooting True Blood at the time here in LA, so I couldn't go.
Yeah.
So this was the first time I was there with a film.
Oh, that's exciting.
It was extraordinary, and also like I was there with a film that actors always say that they love their project, but like this was a special one because it was also like a first time, very young first time filmmaker. We did it on a shoestring budget. No one got paid, but it was just like an incredible experience.
What was it about?
It's sub-dom story set in the world of gay bikers.
Oh, wow.
So I play a biker who takes on a submissive.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a love story.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, and it's about basically their relationship.
Oh, wow. I didn't know there was a gay biker community.
Oh, yeah. We have a bunch of... GBMCC, Gay Biker Motorcycle Club in England. They are, so the other bikers are members of GBMCC.
Oh, okay.
So it was, and they came down to Cannes as well. So they were there.
Oh, that must have been a party.
It was one of the best nights of my life. Like to have them there, one guy in a pup mask.
Yeah.
On the red carpet.
Yeah.
Cannes, and then just to celebrate with, it was a phenomenal night.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Man.
I love that little film. But we're not, that was, it's not coming out anytime soon. So I'm not on.
No, I get it. Yeah.
So like it's.
But the experience was great.
The experience was great. And then we'll see when it's A24. So it might be end of the year or maybe
it'll be
next
out.
Year.
Yeah. But just because Cannes looks like, it looks like a very, you know, it's the thing. It's like the prestige. It's Cannes, right?
It's Cannes, yeah.
Cannes.
Or Cannes, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what they call it.
No, Cannes is right.
Le Cannes.
Yeah, Le Cannes. I don't know why I always mispronounce words my entire life. Cannes. It's Cannes.
I don't think
from
you're
here out.
No, I've heard a lot of people say Cannes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I like Cannes.
I wasn't trying to correct you. I'm sorry if it came across as that.
No, I get what you're doing.
Just because I'm European, I'm trying to be like, no, sir, it's Cannes.
Yeah.
Le Cannes.
But it always looks like that you've like arrived at something important.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely felt like incredible to be at the most prestigious film festival in the world.
That's it.
With a kinky gay biker movie. Yeah. You know,
was, well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. It was good talking to you, pal.
I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
fun.
And congratulations on your retirement from...
Well, we're going to... This show is coming to an end, and it's been a long time. I'm not retiring, but...
I think you are.
You're really? Am I out? Is it time? Is it time to just...
I'm here to tell you that.
You're
it's
done.
You're done.
It's over.
Yeah.
Well, I'm doing other stuff.
Of course you are. But congratulations.
Well, thank you
16
very much.
Years, right?
Yeah.
How many guests?
Well, there's been like over 1,600 episodes.
Oh, my.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's been a lot of guests, dude. Like, it's at the point now where I'm not sure who's been on and who hasn't.
Yeah.
Like, I always think, like, oh, I know you haven't because you're here.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, like, did I interview him? Did I? Like, because Martin Landau, that's a great example of, who would know that I did that? But I got him, you know, and he was very lucid. And as I became more interested in acting, I was able to talk to all these people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have master classes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I had Pacino in here. I had Landau in here.
Alexander Skarsgård. Like, yeah, all the big ones.
Yeah, you. And then the Sarsgaard, not the Skarsgård, that guy.
Oh, everyone thinks we're brothers.
Yeah, you're not. Yeah. What's his first name?
Peter.
Peter, yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can pick brains. Paul Dano was in here, and he's pretty good. A lot of big actors who I talked to.
And not to be presumptuous, but the timing of it all, like, when we confirmed this, that I was going to be on your show, the next day, you announced that the show's coming to an end.
Well, who else is there to talk to?
It might be a bit presumptuous, but was it like 1,600 episodes of leading towards finally getting me on the show? And then you were like, now that I've the pinnacle of my career.
We've been talking about it since, since you were in Zoolander.
Yeah.
You know, we're like, if we ever do a podcast, when they're invented, we got to get this guy on. Yeah. So finally, our mission is complete.
Well, Mark, you're welcome.
Really appreciate it, Alex.
And best of luck with your retirement.
Thank you. There you go. The season finale of Murderbot premieres this Friday, July 11th on Apple TV+. Hang out for a minute. Folks, for you Full Marin subscribers, you can hear me and Chris and Brendan on last Friday's bonus episode talk to a real deal Mount Everest climber. It's AEW wrestler Darby Allin, who made it to the highest point on Earth last month.
A lot of people say it's not about summoning Mount Everest. It's about conquering like yourself and your inside and pulling stuff out. So
okay. All right. Well, I got some questions then. Let's start with the dead people. Now, how many dead people did you walk by?
I believe it was like a total of 8. But, you know, the crazy thing is when I went up and then I instantly, when I did the summon, I was coming back down, you see all these new dead bodies that you didn't see within the last 12 hours.
That just got there?
Yeah, like new ones that died within 12 hours. Yeah.
No, come on. Yeah. People just dropping dead up there like every day?
Oh, I don't know about every day, but it was literally, I went up. When I did the summit and then I was coming down, all of a sudden you see a new dead body that wasn't there on the trail 12 hours ago.
Different jacket.
It was pretty crazy. Cause then you start thinking about your own situation and obviously they don't go there with the death wish. They go there thinking, oh shit, like I'm going to do this motherfucking mountain. And then it just doesn't work out and it's just like you're like, oh my god, how are the Sherpas, they just like leave? It's just like a whole thing that
I don't know why they leave there, but maybe the guy's like, you know, I'm gonna climb this fucking mountain if it's the last thing I do. Right. And it turns out it was.
Yeah. there is a thing called summit fever where people just don't know when to turn around, and I felt that 100%.
We'll have some more of that talk on this Thursday's WTF episode, but Full Marin subscribers can hear the whole thing right now. To sign up, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Angels Everywhere.